Maybe one more?
Just for one more take?
From the top, you want to redo that?
Let's do it one more
time. Let's do a little bit slower.
Okay,
all right, we'll start from... Maybe we should take... There were some parts I stumbled over on that. Maybe one more.
Let's just start from the beginning.
Just for safety. I think that's good.
And blah, blah, blah.
Attention. The material you're listening to is
radioactive.
Hello and welcome to Radioactive,
a youth media program at KUOW.
I'm Kendra Hanna.
And I'm Ian Dongla.
And today we're bringing you stories of people battling the odds.
Battling when they can't win.
But fighting nonetheless.
This is why we fight, why we lie awake. This is why...
In our first story, a woman chooses her own battle.
Sandy Osawa is a member of the Macaw tribe. She works to battle Native American stereotypes.
Her weapon of choice is film.
She and her husband, Yasu, have produced more than 65 films, including 5 PBS documentaries.
And have won numerous awards and accolades for their work.
But even after all this success, her fight isn't over. Radioactive's Rachel Lam has the story.
We sprang from salt water, a meeting of waves. Our men hollowed canoes from logs with the bone of whale. And together we rose as one, but were many. Giving thanks to the sea, we were born, startling the birds into flight while the seagulls cried.
This is the beginning of a poem Sandy Osawa wrote in college. It is a Macaw creation story. This piece would later mark a turning point in Sandy's journey as a filmmaker. It was the summer of 1965. Nia Bay, Washington. Returning home from college, Sandy realized that few people knew the Macaw dances, and only her tribal elders knew the songs. The Macaws were in danger of losing their culture. All across the nation, tribes were facing this same problem. Sandy created a Macaw culture program for youth, where elders passed on their tribal knowledge. It was among the first of its kind in the country. That summer, Sandy brought in her poem.
The teenagers came in the afternoon, I think it was like 7th grade to the 12th grade, and then I told them I was going to read a poem about the macaws, and somebody said, well, why would anybody want to write about us? And I realized that this teenager was telling me that macaws or we are not important enough to have anybody write a poem about. I started to think about the whole impact of self-image, that when you don't see anything positive about your life anywhere, like in newspapers or in the media, it does say something about the fact that you're really ignored as a people. You're really dismissed as a people. And you're, of course, not going to be understood as a people.
The image of American Indians in popular media did not represent the people Sandy knew in everyday life. Sandy grew up with people who were creative and smart, people who had a strong grounding in both the Native American and mainstream American cultures.
The picture that society has and does hold of the American Indian is one of a victim, that Indians are victims and Indians are losers. You know, you might get one story where Indians are the stereotypical wise elder on horseback looking over into the sunset, and you might get sort of a nod for spiritual wisdom, something like this.
Him a beauty, like mountain with snow, silver white, silver. That would be a name for him.
The Lone Ranger is just one example.
Here hat, me wash in stream, dry in sun, make whiter.
Sandy was determined to change the tide.
I heard about an opening at UCLA that they were finally going to get minority students into the film program.
Since attending the UCLA Film School, Sandy has dedicated her entire life to remaking the Native image. Sandy chooses Native American success stories for her films.
there's a resistance. There is a strong resistance to each and every story that I've ever told that Yasu and I have worked on.
In Pepper's Powwow, Sandy featured Jim Pepper, a man who fused traditional Native music with American jazz. One of his best-known songs is Wichitaito, a healing chant he learned from his grandfather.
Water spirit feeding, springing round my head. Makes me feel glad that I'm not dead.
In her film On and Off the Res with Charlie Hill, Sandy presented the importance of humor in the Native community. Charlie Hill's stand-up material revolves around the Native experience and history.
Hi, how are you? Hi, how are you? Hi, how are you?
I'm an Oneida, and I'm from Wisconsin. That's where my people are from. We used to be from New York. We had a little real estate problem.
Anyway, I'm feeling good here. The watch the World Series, and the Cleveland Native Americans lost. Get over it, America. Why are you still making us mascots? The Indians. You know how offensive that is? That's like turning on the game going, today's game is New York's cheap Jews versus the lazy n****s from Alabama. Oh, it got quiet in here.
In her documentaries, Sandy is careful to accurately present the Native perspective, and her thoughtfulness has been acknowledged. She has been honored as Native American Filmmaker of the Year at the Taos Talking Pictures Film Festival. She has received an Outstanding Producer's Citation from KNBC. Her films have gleaned the Best Documentary and Best of Show at the Fargo International Film Festival. Yet these prizes are not the ones Sandy seeks.
You know, your reward is in finding those audiences. And you know that one by one, when you see enlightenment in people's eyes, when you hear their responses, then you know you've reached an audience.
Sandy can see change coming, slowly, perhaps. But film by film, and audience by audience, she believes the tide will turn.
There was one woman in Taos, New Mexico, when we first showed the Charlie Hill film, and afterwards she got up and raised her hand and she said, there was no yelling, there was no preaching, there was none of that, but I suddenly understood why this mascot issue is so important, and I suddenly got it. And so Yasa and I both thought, well, that's really why we did the film, so this is good. This gives you a reason to keep going.
And Sandy and Yasu will keep going. They will continue the battle. Sandy plans to change more minds, one story at a time.
Now our men keep returning to the sea, filled with the rhythm of salmon, flashing a strange beauty through dark waters as silver fins leap wildly over death, seeking the savage moment that saves the young. Our people will not die.
For Radioactive, this is Rachel Long.
Sandy got to choose her own battle.
And she's fighting something we would all like to see gone.
Most people have faced stereotypes of some kind. Most people want to fight them.
But what about when the battle isn't chosen?
When life gives a battle that we never wanted to fight.
But there is no choice.
A battle for our very lives. One we'll all eventually have to face.
And one that we'll all eventually lose.
This is the story of one of those battles. The story of a man's war with the lump in his throat. And the realization that he cannot win. Radioactive's Madeline Eubank has more.
Mr. Nimes is sitting out on my porch, watching the sunset and working on the latest New York Times Sunday puzzle. 52 down. Wake-up times, for short. He's proud of the grizzled chin and the head of wispy gray hair he's been growing, a look his friend likes to call the Amish experiment. But his skin hangs off of his bones, like his cigarettes hang off of his lips.
When I get stressed out, which I do a lot of the time, I revert to going out on my deck and lighting up a cigarette.
He reaches for another from his bright yellow pack of American Spirit. As if nature's loudest colors weren't caution enough, the package is plastered with warnings from the Surgeon General. One declares that smoking may cause cancer, but Mr. Nimes doesn't seem to care. Probably because it already has.
And it's a very difficult thing to quit altogether, even though I have a lot of friends saying you got to stop. But it's almost like a pacifier. I'm not proud of that.
He was diagnosed with throat cancer on
July 5th, 2012. It was determined at that time that I needed a CAT scan, and the person that administered it said, you hear about your cancer, and I wasn't aware that I had cancer, and she said, don't tell the doctor that I told you. Now, there are some people that would be on the internet every day reading about it.
That would be my mom.
I immediately went to the internet and looked up the type of cancer he had. And it didn't look good at all. The survival rate for 5 years was pretty low. But he had a positive attitude about it, and I didn't want to bring up the negative.
So she didn't, because Mr. Knibbs didn't want to know.
And I never gave a darn about the medical aspects of things. It's when my car needs to go to the shop, I just say to the mechanic, fix it. I don't care what it is. And I feel the same way about cancer.
His upbeat attitude seemed to work. Last January, the cancer looked like it was going away. There was talk of more radiation and then maybe even a surgery to remove the lump in his throat once and for all. It was a miracle that the man to beat such a devastating cancer lived off of Pepsi and potato chips and had smoked since he was 12. But in the next CAT scan, his lymph nodes lit up like Fort Knox, meaning the cancer wasn't leaving. It was getting much, much worse.
I was brought back to real life when the doctor told me that it was never going to go away. I said, well, instead of Mount Everest, I'm going to have to find my thrill on Blueberry Hill.
So Mr. Knibbs has been going in for more chemo infusions for the past few months, until 3 weeks ago, when he got more bad news. He was too weak for chemo. So tomorrow he's going in to find out, what now?
Are you nervous for your next appointment?
Am I nervous? Mm-hmm. You bet your life. I'm scared to death. For the first time in all my life, I see that I'm mortal.
Mr. Knibbs used to have this analogy for his battle against cancer.
At the beginning, it was like, each time I had a treatment, it was like another inning, and I would send out an email suggesting, well, I'm now in the seventh inning or the sixth inning, and it was me against Mr. C, as I call cancer. And I'm into extra innings, you might say.
It's fitting, since he met my parents through their softball team. He held the pitcher's mound for more than a decade, until running to first might have popped a lung. So when Mr. Knibbs started his chemo treatment, my dad offered up our spare room as his Seattle base. He told me why he thought Mr. Knibbs was nervous for his next appointment.
He didn't think forward that this day might come, and now he has to. So it seems to be a different chapter unfolding in front of him, and he doesn't know if it's the final chapter.
Being too weak for chemo was a curveball, and it left me wondering, you know, what does this mean for the game against Mr. C? But Mr. Knibbs doesn't like to think that way.
It's like I don't want to go there. I don't want to go past today to think about what might be next. Definitely, like they say in the AA program, one day at a time. And when I wake up in the morning, I say, I've got another day.
So here's the next day at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center. Most of it's waiting around in a lobby full of restless people. Today, Mr. Knibbs is dressed in a faded pink Cape Cod sweatshirt. It's a sure sign that he's in a good mood, but he's also walking with a bad limp. And like always, his friend Jim is here.
Jim lives on Vacheron. He's here for every consult. I said to my daughter, why? Why is everybody so good to me? She says, Dad, you're a good guy. Who thinks they're a good guy, you know?
It's true. Mr. Knibbs lives off of good karma. He adopted his daughter from China. He found a job for his friend Jim. When he was diagnosed with esophageal cancer, his bank account was in the double digits, but he lives comfortably in Ocean Park in a house owned by his friend Candy. He drove her to chemotherapy while she battled cancer. Jim and Mr. Knives lounge in the lobby until finally a nurse calls for John Nyberg, and he is led into a small white room with frightening diagrams. A fellow follows in short order. He asks some questions about Mr. Knives' overall health since his last treatment.
So I'm extremely tired.
How do you feel like that's been in the 3 weeks off?
Well, you know, it's that whole mind-body spirit thing. I get terribly lonely down there, and I have some anxiety because it was made clear to me by Dr. Lynn the last time we talked, I'm going to have cancer for the rest of my life.
The fellow recommends some medication, and Jim writes down what Mr. Knives will need. Then the fellow says he'll fetch Dr. Lynn, who will tell Mr. Knives about the plans for his treatment.
Geez, you're getting the full show today, kid. Hello, fellow. Has he graduated from high school yet?
Stop. He probably hears that a lot.
He had the sweatiest palms of any man I've shook hands with in years.
Mr. Knives cracks jokes to shake the seriousness of the appointment. But this is a moment, a small moment, when his life balances on the edge of a knife. He knows he will face death. It's been made very clear that the odds favor Mr. C. It's only a matter of when. And this 15-minute conversation with his doctor might just determine that.
But I do think now that my mortality is an issue. And what I hope is when that time comes, I will understand what life was all about.
Hello.
Hi, Dr. Lynn.
The doctor is in. For Radioactive, this is Madeline Eubank.
I found my thrill on Blueberry Hill.
Thank you to Maddie and Rachel for their inspirational stories.
This brings us to the end of our show.
And we're fighting back the tears because this is the last podcast for Kendra and me.
We want to thank our hard-nosed generals, Lula Kataev and Jenny Asarno, for their guidance and leadership.
And our brothers and sisters in arms, Rachel Lam, Carlos Nieto, and Isaac Noren.
Amina Ibrahim, Maddie Eubank, and Shrikar Panumaka.
And, of course, you listening to this podcast, who battled through all the distractions on the internet, yes, even those YouTube cat videos, to be here.
Keep up the fight. Tomorrow, check out our very last podcast of the whole summer, hosted by Rachel Lam and Amina Ibrahim.
Also, check out the rest of our podcasts at kuow.org/radioactive.
And like our Facebook page, Radioactive Youth Media.
That's it for us.
I'm Kendra Hanna.
And I'm Ian Dongla.
Thanks for listening.